and I thought I would try to get the quickest bills done first. And can I see a show of hands? Who is here on Senate Bill 688? I think. Why don't we go ahead and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 688? And Art, come on up. And Tom, were you going to? Who else is on 688? I don't have a sign-up sheet with me here. Thanks for coming this morning.
My name is Tom Gallagher with the Urban Developers Coalition. And we have just begun to sit down with the cities, and it looks like the counties on this bill. The home builders and others are in favor of this bill. The department is now, since you scheduled the bill, begin to talk to me about it. And I think we should be able to, in the next 7 to 8 days, come back with a draft that will at least meet my needs and hopefully the needs of the other folks. And I'll let them speak for themselves.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Art Slack with the Association of Oregon Counties. And we're happy to work with Tom Gallagher to address this issue. Our concern is the length of anything that's put in statute with regard to vested rights in terms of time frame. A lot of local ordinances have some provisions, but they deal with phased development and a relatively, I guess, a short period of time of 2 or 3 years at this point. So that's our concern.
I'm sorry, say that last sentence again. What's 2 or 3 years?
What local governments have, at least counties have, some counties have in their ordinances, it relates to phased development.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. I think the two gentlemen already said everything I need to say. We're happy to sit down with Mr. Gallagher and have his client's attorneys meet with ours on this issue. As Mr. Schlack indicated, many of our cities already have some sort of vested rights provision in their ordinances, and although I think the bill probably in terms of definition and timing might be a bit broad, I'm sure that we can have some discussions and come back with you with some comment or a product.
Okay, that'd be fine. I just have a favor to ask. When you have the amendments that you think you've got together an agreement on, could you just set up a 10-minute meeting in my office just with the three of you and anybody else you want to be there? But I'd like to hear about it before we have a hearing.
Certainly, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Okay. Any questions from the committee? Okay, thank you very much. Ross Day?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Ross Day, Oregonians in Action. Given the fact that they're going to be bringing this bill back, I'll just be very brief and express Oregonians in Action support for, in these cases, vested rights issue. Given that individuals invest significant amount of money and time in a development, we certainly support the concept of vested rights in order to provide some semblance of surety in the land use process. But with that, I'll work with the extent that I can with the group and look forward to coming back and addressing this issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anybody else on this bill? Okay. Let's close then the public hearing on Senate Bill 688. And Senator Przanski, we have a couple other bills that I think should go quickly, if
fine.
You don't mind. And then you lead off on yours. Let's go ahead and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 871. Tim Keith and Dustin Gustafson, please.
Chair Ringo, members of the committee, my name is Tim Keith, Assistant State Forester in charge of fire protection for the Oregon Department of Forestry. With me today is Dustin Gustafson, our legislative intern this month, and in real life, he's our fossil assistant unit forester. You have in front of you, I believe just now, a written testimony that Dustin prepared on behalf of the department. The department does support the intent of Senate Bill 871. We've been working hard in similar directions, promoting utilization of forest biomass and promoting cleanup around homes. We stand ready to provide any assistance necessary to help make this a good bill. We believe it's still a work in progress. We were recently asked for input on the bill, and we assigned Dustin the task. And with that, I'll let Dustin go through some of the recommendations we have.
Thank you.
As Tim mentioned, I'm Dustin Gustavson. And the input ODF provided, we provide input to who the credit should be available. I believe there's an amendment in the works on this bill. The definition that we used would limit this credit to owners of structures of improved lots within the forest, in the forest land that's paying fire patrol assessment. We limit it to these folks because these folks are providing to the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund, and they're paying for a level of protection in the forest land. And also, this definition holds those who claim the credit to a set of standards for this type of work. Specifies how much clearing needs to be done around structures and driveways and so on. We also provide input to the dollar figure of the credit of $500 is a number that we threw out there. And this was based on about the average size of a lot in an urban interface area. It was about 5 acres with heavy fuel loading. You know, it could be about 10 tons. And the cost of that would be about $10 a ton on the low end to get it hauled to some sort of facility. So we came up with $500 from that. We also provide input on the definition of removal and disposal. There are increased methods available these days for the utilization of forest biomass waste. And we feel there's greater benefits to the environment and society the more this material is beneficially utilized rather than burn on site. So we kind of tailored the removal and disposal definition to reflect that. So rather than folks just piling it and burning it in the backyard, that this material would be utilized in some fashion. Okay, a little background. Currently, there's about 130,000 improved lots on forest land paying forest patrol assessment in the state.
So how much?
130,000.
Okay.
Several efforts, and there's been increasing efforts since fires of the recent past to reduce the risk and impact of fire around structures within the state to protect structures and the resource. Most of these efforts have been focused primarily in the southwest and eastern Oregon areas, and a lot of this effort is through the National Fire Plan, the Department of Forestry, or the National Fire Plan is a federal incentive program in which the Department of Forestry has received nearly $17 million for the efforts to reduce the risk and impact of wildfires on the ground. These projects are based on locally determined priorities. They are not widespread projects. They are narrowly focused. ODF has also recently implemented Forest Land Urban Interface Act of 1997, which is also commonly referred to as Senate Bill 360. We have recently implemented this act in Jackson and Deschutes counties, and we are on track to implement in several other counties in the near future. But even with National Fire Plan and Senate Bill 360, these are both narrowly focused, and this leaves many structures in the forest land that aren't taking steps to become safe from wildfire. And I think attached to the testimony, there's a couple maps there that we can reference. It shows kind of how the fire regime in Oregon and also the United States has changed from historical levels. And you can see by looking at that map that I believe it says 77% of the state has changed. And poses a greater risk of wildfires from the historical levels. And it's just not a southwest and an eastern Oregon issue. It's a statewide issue. So I guess to finish, the issue of reducing fire risk in interface areas around structures isn't just for southwest and eastern Oregon, but it's for all of Oregon. That's why we support the intent of this bill. It gives citizens throughout the state within a forest protective district the same incentives to reduce the fuels around their home. And it can have far-reaching benefits than what we can accomplish in the short term. We are setting priorities on the local level, focused at taking care of one subdivision at a time. This bill has the ability to reach out to everybody. So I'd like to just thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you very much, Senator Atkinson.
Thank you very much. It's been great working with both of you to get the amendments drafted. Where are we in the process of getting these definitions spelled out?
I believe the amendment, or Senator Ringo, or Chair Ringo, Senator Atkinson, the amendments were submitted, I believe, Monday evening, Tuesday morning, and they were supposed to be printed sometime here in the near future, if not already. So.
Chair Ringo, Senator Atkinson, we just started working on it last week, and frankly, we do think that there are some additional opportunities. We continue to put the creative energy to it. Perhaps there is some opportunity, if it's the will of the committee, for us to continue to refine that with you, Senator Atkinson, and your staff.
Thank you. Committee, 1997 legislature passed Oregon Forestland Urban Interface Fire Protection Act, and this is simply to build upon that. The governor last week announced that this will be the second driest summer on record, and this really came to my attention when our office was trying to find homes for livestock and horses, and then over time, as the Biscuit Fire grew into the city, buying homes for people who were put out of their homes simply because the Biscuit Fire got out of control and threatened cities. So this is actually building on what was happening in 1997, but has been a wonderful firefighting tool, ultimately saves money. So thank you, and I'm pretty eager to get this bill moving.
Thank you. Couple questions. You said that you were thinking that the tax credit would be up to $500 per taxpayer. Is that it?
Chair Ringo, we just threw $500 out as a starting point. Our input, like I mentioned, the average tax lot within an urban interface area is about 5 acres. A heavy fuel loading on that property in most interface areas is about 10 tons to the acre. So that's 50 tons that a landowner could potentially remove off of their property. The cost to remove biomass and haul it to some sort of either facility to process it or chip it on site is very variable. It ranges from about $10 a ton to $35, $40 a ton, depending on whether there's a commercial contractor involved in hauling it in chip vans and so on. So we started with the lower end, $10 a ton, at 50 tons, and that came up to about $500.
Well, that's fine, but I guess my next question is then, what is the potential hit to our state budget in terms of the expected use of the tax credit? Is there any revenue analysis on that?
Chair Ringo, members of the committee, frankly, we don't know. I'm not really sure at this point, and do not have an analysis.
Okay. Yeah, the whisper in my ear was that we have a referral to revenue, so maybe then we'd refer to revenue and they would work out those details. What you contemplate is removing the materials. Right now, it may be burned, and you're trying to encourage another method besides burning.
Chair, that's correct. Burning is becoming an increasing issue all the time, especially when you're getting into these urban interface areas. There's more people out there. It's having more effects on the health of the citizens around.
Right. Okay. But one method would be to chip it on site. If somebody chipped it on site, then they would qualify for the tax credit.
Chair and members of the committee, that's correct.
And another method would be to have it removed to some facility that would presumably chip it themselves.
Yes, that's correct.
I see. And if the materials were taken to a facility to be chipped, do you assume those materials would somehow be used in a commercial way? They would be used in some wood product?
Well, Chair and members of the committee, one method would be taking it to an established biomass facility.
I don't know what that is. I don't know what a biomass facility is.
Okay, a biomass facility, I believe there's one in Medford. Basically, the material is chipped and burnt in the facility to create energy, electricity.
I see.
Also sometimes referred to as a cogen plant.
Right, okay, I got you.
I believe in Medford, some figures that I saw that folks bringing in material in the back of their pickups amounted for 25% of the material that plant took in last year.
Okay. I'm getting educated on the side here. Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Okay. Thanks very much. Let me know when you have the amendments worked up, and maybe we'll talk to my committee staff when you have those worked up so we can talk about them further, okay?
Chair Wingo, members of the committee will do that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's close the public hearing on Senate Bill 871, and let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 677. Michael Holston? Could you get Brzezinski just for the next bill?
Okay, he's stuck.
Chair Lingo, members of the committee, my name is Mike Holston. I'm one of the board members on the Land Use Board of Appeals, and I'm appearing here today to offer some comments on Senate Bill 677. Senate Bill 677 amends ORS Chapter 197 to provide that if LUBA does not issue a final decision in an appeal within the 77-day deadline established by statute, the local government's decision would be considered affirmed without a final order from LUBA, effectively a LUBA AWOP. The LUBA was created in 1979 and began hearing appeals in that year. Before LUBA was created, land use decisions went straight to circuit court, and for a short period of time before that went to LCDC hearings officers. The primary reason LUBA was created was to speed final resolution of land use appeals. We have approximately 240 cities, and we have 36 counties in this state, and I hear various estimates, but somewhere in the neighborhood of 10,000 to 15,000 land use decisions get rendered each year. In 2004, 223 of those were appealed to LUBA. And in those fields, we have a variety of appellants. We have the appellants that most people picture, and that is land use or neighbors opposing a permit approval. But we also have a fair number of appeals that involve applicants who have been denied a permit by a local government or have had their permits conditioned in ways that they think are improper. We have two key performance measures. I have submitted some written material. I'm assuming you have that before you. Attached to that material are pages from LUBA's annual performance report. One of those pages is Appendix D4, and that shows what we consider our most important performance measure, which measures the timeliness of our opinions. There's another appendix, Appendix D8, that shows our performance measure 4, which measures LUBA's performance in having its opinions affirmed on appeal to the Court of Appeals. If we could turn to D4 first, you'll notice that we only go back to 1999 on this chart, but beginning in the mid-1990s, LUBA suffered a serious backlog in appeals. And if you'll notice in 1999, only approximately, and this performance, let me go back, this performance measure measures the percentage of appeals in which LUBA issues its decision within that 77-day statutory deadline, or, if all the parties agree, within no more than a 7-day extension of that deadline. So that's the measure, and our target for that performance measure is 90%. So returning to the table, in 1999, the percentage of meeting that performance measure was 52%. It was 53% in 2000. We began achieving that, getting close to that measure in 2001, and since that time in 2002 and now in 2004, we're meeting the performance measure. 2003 was an off year. The main thing that happened to us in 2003 was due to the budget crisis that came along that year. Our staff attorney we had to let our staff attorney go for a period of about 6 or 7 months. This practice that I mentioned of seeking agreement from the parties for a 7-day extension is something that LIBA has been doing for quite some time. The parties almost always agree to that 7-day extension because it allows LIBA some flexibility to reassign resources to the pending cases that we have. And the parties generally agree to that 7-day extension because they know from our past practice that they can be reasonably assured that the opinion is going to come out within that short extended deadline. I'm going to turn briefly to the cost that we see to Senate Bill 677. If we assume the purpose of this bill is to make sure that LIBA issues as close as we can get to 100% of our opinions within that 77-day deadline,
okay, I just have a question just to interject for a second. I understand these are percentages within the deadline, but do you have any statistics on how long, say, the longest decisions may take? How many decisions went to 100 days, 120 days?
Chair Rango, members of the committee, I don't have those figures with me today, but I can tell you that the current, during the past year, 2004, there were a handful, and I'm going to guess about 4 or 5 cases where the delay was as much as a month.
So a month past the 77-day deadline.
In other cases, it's a matter of a few days.
Okay. Is there any point where beyond a certain timeline there is some sort of sanction?
Chair Rango's members of the committee, yes, there is. And going back to that period in the late 90s up to about year 2000, in many cases, those opinions were going out as much as 6 months after the statutory deadline. And the remedy that's provided by the statute is that any party can file a mandamus action in Marion County Circuit Court to have the court order LIBA to issue an opinion.
That doesn't seem like a very easy remedy, though, to make them file another action.
Chair Lingo, members of the committee, to my knowledge, that's only been done once.
Okay, but there is no deadline, for example, where at 120 days or 150 days, something specific happens.
Chair Lingo, members of the committee, the mandamus action is the only thing I'm aware
of. Okay, thank you.
Turning to the cost, if the goal is to have LIBA issue 100% of its opinions within that 77-day deadline, if it's possible, it would require a fairly extravagant level of staffing. It would require far more personnel than we have at the moment. It's our estimate that, let me get some figures on this. At any given point in time, LIBA can have 10 to 15 appeals that have been through the oral argument process and are ready for a final opinion. And at that point, we have approximately 28 days, or it's actually a little bit less than 28 days, to issue the final decisions in those appeals. And the way I get to that figure, the 77-day statutory deadline works like this. We have 21 days for the appellant to write their brief. We have 21 days for the responding party to write their brief. And the fastest we can schedule our argument following the filing of the final brief is 7 days. So we've now consumed 49 days of that 77-day statutory period, leaving us with this, at the most, 28 days to write that opinion. And in the typical situation, we probably have something around 10 cases that have been through the oral argument process that need opinions to be written. But that can get up to as high as 15 or more and can drop other periods. It's this fluctuation in our caseload that presents the problem when we get into those cases where we've got more than 15 appeals through the oral argument process and opinions due, and particularly where we have cases that are unusually difficult. That's when the 77-day deadline becomes a problem. We've indicated that under this bill, at a minimum, to get up probably close to 95% performance on the 77-day line, at least another half-time staff attorney would be required. And we were working with legislative fiscal to come up with final figures. I'm going to estimate that that would, the annual cost in the next biennium would be $60,000 and probably $90,000 following them, but I'll defer to them on the exact figures on that.
Those are annual costs?
Those will be biennial costs. And I want to go back to a point I was making just before. Even with this half-time staff attorney or full-time staff attorney, we're probably not going to get to that 100% figure, but we could get close with a full-time staff attorney. The problem is that when you've staffed up for the very busiest periods, that staff attorney would almost certainly be underutilized during the more normal periods of time. I'll turn briefly to what
I see. If you could just wrap up in another minute here. We've got a lot of people on a lot of bills.
I've indicated just quickly a couple of what I believe are probably unintended consequences. First, this bill doesn't distinguish between appeals of permit applicants who have been denied approvals. Under this bill, an appeal in that circumstance, if we didn't issue a decision, would be automatically affirmed. I guess the big point that I would like to make, and I'm going to just make one of these final points. I've set them out in the written material, and I'll just leave it there.
Okay. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
This bill doesn't make it clear, at least to me, what would happen if a decision by LUBA, a decision was affirmed without an opinion. If that was appealed to the Court of Appeals, it's very unclear to me what the Court of Appeals would do with such an appeal. They wouldn't have a decision from LUBA to review. So one result might be that they would just remand it back to LUBA for an opinion. If the intent is that the court would actually review the local government decision, intent is really not expressed in the bill. And in our view, that probably would make the process take longer rather than shorten the process.
Okay.
And I'll cut it off there.
Okay. Thank you very much. Questions from me?
Mr. Chair, it's my bill, and I'll do some testifying on it myself.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's any questions.
What's that?
I'm waiting if nobody else has any questions.
Okay, I don't think so. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I've got some, it's the statute that is the exception, to the this bill. And as a background, I spent a lot of time going around a lot of the state during the interim talking about what we do right and what we do wrong with citizens. And the thing that kept coming up over and over again is that one of the things that was harming economic development more than anything else was the fact that people who wanted to locate here, wanted to change, to do something to foster economic development, couldn't get decisions in Oregon to do something. On average, if a person wanted to put up some kind of a building, start a business or something in a jurisdiction, it could be up to 2 years plus before they can get a decision. And we started it. And then our neighboring states, you know, it depends on the states, but Idaho, for instance, was less than 6 months. So you got direct competition. Arizona, I think, was about 8 months average. So, as we're trying to find businesses and get people to come here, we're stifling the process because we can't make decisions or people have no certainty. And what I was told over and over again is that even if the answer is no, at least we can move to a new site and look for something new. But when we apply for something, to do something, and we have to wait years to get an answer, it's people just aren't willing to do that when they're trying to start a new business or do something different with their businesses. So we came to this issue that if we could speed up the process, that would help. Like I said, even if they get the answer they don't want, at least they've got an answer and they can move to a new site or move somewhere else. So we came up with this idea, and I appreciate the testimony that we just received and what would happen if the 77-day limit wasn't reached. Perhaps we need to work on that, and that's an issue that I'd like to discuss to see what would happen. You know, the intent here isn't to get it, make the process take longer, but to speed it up. So as far as the cost, I think what this would do, it would force LUBA to prioritize. Maybe there are some decisions that they could look at and say, look, this is going to the circuit court anyway. We just, you know, let it go rather than, and that's where we need to define what would happen then in the bill. And I think that's important that we do that. So I'll work on amendments to do that. But that is another process I thought of, and I don't know if they do now, is maybe use the ALJ process, you know, the CHOP or the HOP or whatever we're calling it now, that possibly they could use that process when they had extra workload that they needed. So anyway, Mr. Chair, that's the reason for the bill. I've given you the statutory reference of the exceptions that are in 840 and 845, 197, 840, and 845. I will be working on this bill. I understand that Director Shetterly has given testimony saying that it could take longer because the Court of Appeals would have to figure out what to do with it. Well, we can define that in the bill. I recognize Senate Bill 82 may or may not be a work group in the future. If we don't get this bill this time, certainly that should become part of that work group if we get that work group. But that's $1 million item that we're not guaranteed that's going to happen yet either. So I appreciate the testimony, and I wish the people from Lebanon, I don't know if there's anyone else here to testify, but okay. I wish the people from Lebanon were here, because they're the ones that have really been frustrated by this issue for years down there. So anyway, I'll continue to work on it, Mr.
Okay.
Chair. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Senator Byron. Just from my perspective, I agree with you that if people, I've heard that as well. If the answer is going to be no, they might as well hear it sooner than later. I was impressed, though, that given the time schedule, they could conceivably have only 28 days to write the opinion, and that seems like a pretty short time to have the body write the opinion. So I'm not sure that this is the mechanism to shorten the whole period, but it certainly does need to be looked at. So.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that, and I'll talk with him. And maybe 77 days isn't the right number, but that's the number in statute now, so we just wanted to define what happens when that time period runs out, because, as you said, going to Marion County Court and issuing a writ mandamus to tell them to act.
That's no solution that works.
Yeah.
So. Okay.
Thank you, Mr.
Just before we get to Senate Bill 291, we have a lot of people in that bill. We only have two people, on Senate Bill 733, and I'd like to hear them quickly. I don't know if your answers. So could you come up, Jeff Bissonnette and Sean Miller, and give a shortened version, and if we need to have a more detailed time here. But I do want to get to the people and Senator Przanski's issue. Okay. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Bissonnette. I'm with the Fair and Clean Energy Coalition, and we are here to testify in support of Senate Bill 733. 733 is an attempt to restructure an existing solar residential energy tax credit to encourage residential customers to install solar systems on their residences. The bill as written is actually a little bit broader than we had originally intended, and we've been working with the Department of Energy, who is here in the audience today, to kind of limit the bill and limit the revenue impact. The bill outlines several technologies, photovoltaic or PV systems, water heaters, and others, and we would like the bill just to focus on photovoltaic systems, which limits the revenue impact to no impact in the current biennium and about $500,000 in the next biennium, the 07-09 biennium.
So you'll get those amendments to us.
And we
now
can get those amendments to you. Sure. And that's all I'd say. John Miller from the Oregon Solar Energy Industry Association has a couple of remarks on the economic impact, and then we'll be done.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Miller.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Miller. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association, and again, I'm speaking in favor of Senate Bill 733. It's needed for several reasons. The first reason is that the current tax credits are artificially limiting the size of installed solar systems, and that's for a very simple reason. These were designed for smaller off-grid systems. Now the vast majority of systems going in are larger grid-tied systems. So 733 will enable people to install those properly sized systems. Senate Bill 733 is not an increase in the tax credits. It's a restructuring. People can get the same amount. You can see that by the table that I have in the written testimony, how people are doing that now and how they can install the same thing up front to make it much more simply to get the same exact tax credit. The third reason by far means the most to our economy and local jobs. The solar industry is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today. It's 2004, that was 40%. And we're trying to attract solar manufacturers to Oregon. Senate Bill 733 is a major part of that effort. We are competing with other states for the big prize, and the big prize today is California. California is the third largest solar market in the world, and all the states around California know that. They know it very well. In fact, Washington State is one of those states. It's getting national attention right now for some legislation that they passed 49-1 in their Senate. This is an article online. The first sentence says some of the most progressive renewable energy legislation ever proposed by a U.S. state is steamrolling its way through Washington State's legislature. So,
now, would you be able to make that available to our committee?
I can, yes.
Okay.
I don't have enough copies
today.
That's
okay. Not right now.
Okay.
But, yeah, I'd like to get it in the bill file.
Sure. So that's for, they're doing it for the same reason that we're trying to pass 733. California's got all the solar, but they have high land values, high building costs, high operating costs, so they're looking for other places to put their manufacturing sites. I've spoken to three manufacturers recently in the last 6 months. One was looking at Bend, one's looking at Grants Pass, and one's looking at Portland. So it's important to note the jobs from this bill will touch virtually every legislative district in Oregon, and passing 733 will keep Oregon in the race to attract manufacturers, which can provide thousands of jobs and economic opportunities for our future.
Okay. Thank you very much, Senator Shields.
One question. You have a nice little chart here that shows the watts installed and doing it all at once, the advantage of taking the credit over the 4 years. The thing that's missing in the chart that I'd like to know is what's the differential in cost if you install that 2,000 watts all at once versus doing 500 a year?
It'll be much cheaper because the contractor only has to come out once. So I don't have the actual cost, but it's certainly going to be more cheaper to have them come out at once. There's other technical reasons that get kind of long-winded. The systems today are becoming more plug-and-play. So in the past, you could do the 500, 500, 500 much easier. The inverters today, if you put a small load on them, 500 or even a little bit more than that, they don't work properly. They don't work as efficiently. So it's not only is it better to have them do it in all at once, but technically speaking, with the inverters that are out there today, the equipment that's used with this, it's bad to do it 500, 500, 500 like that. It's the equipment can't handle it quite as well as it used to, because it's becoming a more packaged equipment now, plug and play. It's made to handle a certain size.
Thank you.
Senator Byrne. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What does it cost to put in a 2,000-watt solar system in an existing home?
That's 2,000 watts. Its current installed costs in Oregon today are around $7 a watt. So that would be about $14,000. That system, the price.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Get those amendments to my committee staff as soon as you have them. And if you, Mr. Miller, if you could provide copies. Frankly, I found a lot of the material that you read interesting. If you could provide a copy of that testimony as well as that article, that'd be great.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let's close the public hearing on Senate Bill 733. Let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 291. Sorry to keep you waiting, Senator Prezansky. Do you want to come up together with Tim Hoover and
Lindsey Hassel?
Okay. Thank you very much. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members, for hearing Senate Bill 291. I need to give you a little bit of perspective. The gentlemen that are seated to my left, your right,
are basically individuals that have come forward from my communities that want to bring forward an issue that I think is worthy of the legislature to look at. On my far left is Jim Hoover. Mr. Hoover is the owner of a company that basically does sort recycling for different businesses in the sense of either contracting with individuals who provide trash service or with management companies that have multifamily dwellings. And basically what they're there to do is basically sort out recycling material from dumpsters and allowing the stuff that needs to go to the landfill to go there and others to go back into the recycling stream. Lindsay Haskell is a city councilor from Cottage Grove. Lindsay and I have worked together on multiple issues. Lindsay is the individual that actually brought me in contact with Mr. Hoover. Lindsay explained to me the issues that he saw with his with the situation, and he'll give you the perspective from Cottage Grove, where he is a city councilor, as to why he thinks that what is before you in 291 is important. My background in recycling, I served on the Bring Recycling Board, which is the oldest recycling organization in the Lane County area for 10 years. I'm currently on their campaign, a capital campaign, to build a new facility. And so I've been very involved in wanting to make certain that we sort out recyclables and making certain that they are basically put back into the stream for commerce where they can be. And the only stuff that goes into the landfill is the solid waste that cannot be recycled. The reason for that is very simple. We have very limited space that's available for municipal solid waste material, and so we should do everything we can to protect it. What I want to bring to the committee's attention is basically there's only three changes in the laws that are being proposed. On page 2, line 35, you'll see in bold print what would be one of the goals of the state to promote source separation of recyclable materials from the solid waste. On page 3, line 41, it says professional, and I'll say that again, professional source separation by a third party. The last is on page 9 of the bill. It's lines 39 through 44, and it basically talks about who is actually able to go in and actually perform this work. I will tell you today, the bill may not be written as perfectly as it should be. We can, in fact, go back and like define on line 40 who that person is, what their affiliation has to be in this process, so we don't have just anyone and everyone jumping into a facility or into a solid waste box to pull stuff out. Now, before I turn it over to Mr. Haskell and Mr. Hoover, I want to let you know that I've been contacted by a number of the people that you're going to be hearing from in opposition to this bill. I will tell you that this has been kind of a full-court press from the very beginning because I know some people question why would I be involved with this knowing my experience and position on recycling. It's the concept that I'm here on. It's not the man. I'll tell you that Mr. Hoover does not have horns. He does not have a tail. I'm asking you to look at the concept that is being forward, not the individual or allegations that have happened. If we're going to go down to that road, then let's have another hearing. We'll talk about what has happened in that perspective. I hope it doesn't go to that level, but instead that we actually have a logical, intelligent discussion on what is best for the state and how we can keep recyclable material out of the stream of the solid waste landfill. With that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Haskell and Mr. Hoover.
Okay, thank you. Before we get there, I just want to mention something to the audience. My committee staff just gave me the sign-up sheet on Senate Bill 785. It wasn't in my stack earlier. There's four people signed up on this bill. I think at least three. If somebody's come from a distance for this bill, I'd like to know that. And I think most of the folks are local. But is it Bob Terry? Did you? I'm sorry. Where are you from, Mr. Terry?
Yes, good morning.
Gaston, well, you did come from the ways. I'll try to make sure to get you in on this bill before the end of the hearing. I'm just concerned that we're going to run out of time, but I'd like to do that. So go ahead and testify, and we may take some folks out of order to hear Mr. Terry later on. But so I'm sorry to interrupt you. Go
That's
ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman Ringo, members of the committee. My name is Lindsay Haskell. I'm a city councilman in Cottage Grove. Why I'm here is because I don't have an axe to grind and I got nothing to benefit from this. He can't do business in my town as the way my ordinance is written today. The garbage company is in full control of waste removal and recycling, period. I checked. When I first was approached by Mr. Hoover through a friend who told me he came to me as an elected official and said, hey, look at what I've been through. Is this right? And I looked at it, and I said, geez, you know, Salem went way out of their way to beat you up. You, what have you done? And he said, well, this is what I do. And he told me what he did, and I said, man, this is, I use the word hinky. Yeah, you can't do this. You can't get into the pocketbook of the garbage company and expect them to like it. And I said, as city governments, we have franchises with these folks, and you can't expect them to not take care of their franchisee. After all, in the city of Cottage Grove, we love our franchisee. He gives me $35,000 a year, and I buy a police officer with it. So you can see I don't want to mess with that police officer. It's kind of, one affects the other. But when Mr. Przyzinski here was finally elected, I had some soul searching. When it causes one, when he gets involved with this, to educate himself a little bit and start looking at those green monsters out there. And I can't seem to go by one without peeking in. And I'm beginning to see what's in there. And I begin to see the value of this concept. And I said, we just can't say no. In our enthusiasm to protect our franchisees, we ignore the obvious. And the obvious is that this is a problem. We give folks recyclable containers. Residences do a pretty good job. You don't find motor oil and batteries and tires in their trash cans. But the green monsters contain all of it. And once it goes in the can, it's in the landfill. Now, our landfill is called Short Mountain. Well, it used to be. It's now quite large.
Tall Mountain.
Tall Mountain, yeah. And so this, I embraced this concept, and I said, there's got to be a way. Now, I come from Cottage Grove. We're kind of a can-do city. And I'm sure you remember the All-American City quotes, and the we think we can. Well, I said, I think I can do this. And so I introduced these two gentlemen and said, see what we can come up with. It's a simple thing to me. Now, when I got involved fully, I began to hear the feedback. As he tells you, it's a full court press. As I sit here today, I can only imagine what Senator Corcoran went through with a room full of union people and talking to you about purge reform. This is, you just don't go there. This is big. I still believe that this can be done. And I ask you that, I know we're up against a big mountain of anti-recycling. But let's say this. From this day forward, let's at least work towards a communication. Maybe sitting down at a table and looking at the future of recycling. Because I believe the landfills shouldn't have this stuff in them, that they're growing faster than they need to, and that it is our job to take care of this. I really don't want to look at my grandkids or my great-grandchildren and have them say, they could have done something, why didn't they? And we didn't do it. And I'd like Mr. Hoover to tell you about where he started and how he got to where he is today and how many happy customers he has. And Mr. Hoover.
Chair Ringo, members of the committee, my name is Jim Hoover, P.O. Box 225. To Eugene, Oregon, 97402. I want to thank Senator Przyzinski for sponsoring this bill. I was wanting you to know how widespread it is right now, the service that we provide. It's in Albany, Corvallis, Kaiser, Salem, Beaverton, Hillsboro, Alloa. Another affiliated company I was with, Eugene Springfield, probably 72 or better percent of all the apartment communities are having this service provided. You'll hear a different, from my adversaries, you'll hear an entirely different concept of what I do than what my customers will tell you I do. So I'd like to make you aware of the difference in, if you talk to my customers versus the garbage industry, it would be different. I've made this, I know that our time is limited here. I didn't have a verbal presentation. I'd like to lend more time to Councilman Haskell if he needs it.
Well, Mr. Hoover, I guess I'd like to ask you, I read a little bit about this issue and heard a little bit about it before the committee hearing today, but could you just give me the 30-second synopsis what your business does?
Okay.
How does it operate?
Chair Ringo, committee members, we begin with a six-day service, often seven-day service. We go around and clean and maintain around the garbage areas of apartment complexes. A typical day would be to come look into the dumpster, pull the various recyclables out of there, and put
these
in.
These are your employees?
Yes, they are.
And have they had training? Do they know what
they've had full training. This business actually started in 93. We have never had an accident throughout the whole history of this company.
So you've been in business since 93?
Actually, an affiliated company. I've been in this business for about 5 years.
I see. Okay.
So along with that, what we do is I say that we increase recycling 300 to 500% at every property we go to. Interestingly enough, nobody really wants to hear about it. In other words, the cities, the counties, no one wants to. The garbage haulers certainly don't want to know how much we increase. So that's just me saying it. And
how many employees do you have?
I have eight employees total. Six actually work,
okay.
Do the job.
And what kind of stuff do they pull out of the dumpsters?
They pull out cardboard, tin, glass, paper. Now, we don't get everything. If we got everything, I don't think the garbage industry would need to be picking up very much at all. So it's time sensitive. We're going to get the larger cardboard. We're going to get the milk jugs. The other thing we do is to clean and maintain the recycling. So what you have is a real difference between residential garbage and apartment garbage. The industry knows this. You've got the big green monster that's being filled with, 100 different people are servicing that particular can, which means that one person that abuses the can by throwing things in there that don't belong in there leaves less room for the other people. So there's a lot to be said. I actually was on good advice, and you'll probably be happy to know I made this very small. I could have made about an inch thick packet, and I've done that before in other situations I've been in and found that I don't know if everybody's able to read it all with all you have to do.
Mr. Chair, the other thing I guess I want to point out, and I'm going to ask Mr. Haskell to do this, how companies around this country have actually, that are solid waste removal companies, are actually partnering up with people such as Mr. Hoover or his companies to actually pull stuff out and work together. And this is what I think Mr. Haskell was talking about, getting around the table and having people try to work things out. But he has some stuff that he'd like to share with you regarding a very large trash hauler back in the Midwest.
Chairman Ringo, committee members, when I realized the opposition, and I must admit I was a little surprised that my own lobbyist, the League of Cities, took opposition to this several weeks ago and said no. Without even hearing the concept, you assume no. But city government, they work for them. My garbage company that I do business with in my city, I've talked to him several times about this issue because I wanted the perspective of an actual garbage company. And he gave me this magazine. It's a national publication. This is this month's. It's Wastage here. On the inside is an article from Chicago. It seems the city of Chicago runs their own garbage company. They actually do the hauling. And a company called Allied out of Scottsdale, Arizona, does all the recycling. They have partnered up with private recyclers. And the three entities now, and it's kind of convoluted, but the private haulers must haul the recycling to Allied. Chicago agrees to haul all recycling to Allied. When the materials are sold, the profits are split one-third, one-third, one-third. They're screaming because they don't have enough material. They want more because it's generating dollars. Chicago figures $1 to $2 million the first year. If they can do this with a large garbage company, why can't we? That's all I'm saying.
Mr. Chair, there is a DVD that's in the packets. They're all ready to provide the community an opportunity to see part of that today if time permits. There's actually, I think, two different operations they show, but if the committee wanted to see how it actually works, they're willing to do that. But we also understand with the time and stuff that you may.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to be looking at any videos or DVDs today.
Good.
But we do have it in the pack. I appreciate it. I appreciate very much your testifying. Are there questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to go ahead and excuse myself for some commitments.
Okay.
And they'll be here.
Okay. Well, thank you, too, for testifying. And
thank you, Chair.
If you could just sit back.
Committee, thank you.
Oh, no, you're very welcome. I would like to
recess the hearing on Senate Bill 291 and open a hearing on Senate Bill 785 for Bob Cherry to come up and testify, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
I didn't want you driving from Gaston twice, Mr. Cherry.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm here to give you a little history on the Senate bill. I'm sure you've heard of, probably more commonly known to you as sudden oak death. We think of it as P. ramorum or Phytophthora ramorum, which was a disease that had hit the plant world here in Oregon last year. The Oregon industry is a very pristine industry in our state, and it was certainly a shining spot in our economy.
For the record, you need to state your name.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Robert Terry. Need my address?
No, that's okay. Just your name.
Robert Terry from Gaston, Oregon. And the sudden oak death had a very devastating effect on our industry last year. We really dodged a bullet, and what we are asking to do is put up our own money with the Oregon Department of Agriculture to protect us in the event of such a thing in the future from ever happening again. The idea is to have the money available to us so that we can fight this through any other disease that may come into the state to protect the industry and to protect the state. No doubt, it only protects our industry. It also protects other industries such as forestry and Christmas trees.
Okay. Thank you very much. Is there any testimony from the committee? Okay. Well, for the rest of the witnesses on this bill, I'm sure we're just going to have to move this back to another day, and I apologize for that. But we'll definitely be looking at this further.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cherry. So let's close the public hearing on Senate Bill 785. Let's go back to our public hearing on Senate Bill 291. And let's see, Kristen Mitchell and Robert, is it Silo? Do you want somebody else to come up with you? Okay. I'm sorry. People write City of Salem, so I don't know what that means here, but Nanke?
Nanke.
Okay. And I have a Beth Vargas Duncan, is that?
Yeah, she just ran up to feed the parking meter.
Okay. They're vicious here in Salem on that parking. You got to somehow you would be an apt victim, though, I have to say.
Parking is definitely an issue in our fine city.
Okay.
And if Beth comes back in... I'll just have her come up front with me. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Salem City Councilor Brad Nanke, and I come before you today representing the City of Salem in opposition to Senate Bill 291. This is a piece of my personal background. I am a Marion County Master Recycler, and I'm the Environmental Health and Safety Manager for a manufacturer here in the City of Salem as well. So I'm well-versed in recycling if you have any questions to that end. The Salem City Council held a public hearing regarding this specific issue on July 8th of 2002. Waste Recovery Systems, the same entity that's before you here today, had also requested a City of Salem public hearing. We did submit a video into the record from that public hearing that you could review at your leisure. After receiving public testimony and reviewing lengthy and diverse amounts of information, the Salem City Council unanimously passed a resolution disallowing WRS an exception to existing city code, so WRS could not legally operate within the city limits of Salem. The following points summarize concerns previously considered by the City of Salem Council and illustrate Salem's current opposition to Senate Bill 291. First, public health, safety, and liability issues. The City of Salem regulates garbage and recycling services within the city limits. There are concerns from Salem's risk management regarding authorization of WRS employees, typical activities of climbing into dumpsters, stomping down garbage, tearing open garbage bags, and letting out rotting food, then hand-sorting the garbage. Video shown during the Salem public hearing shows WRS employees wearing T-shirts and other non-protective clothing from the knees up. What would the liability be if a WRS employee got stuck with a needle in this process? According to DEQ, food is the number one item in residential waste, followed by disposable diapers at number four, and then animal feces as number eight. The current system isn't broken under Salem City Code. Franchise haulers provide garbage and recycling services. In order to obtain an exception from the code and provide these services, the applicant needed to show that the existing haulers are not providing the service. The haulers provided multi-unit recycling services in advance of any city requirement. As noted in 2002, one of the haulers' mixed recycling programs at multi-unit complexes increased to 5,500 tons per month, an 1,100% increase. According to DEQ, Marion County has a 53% recovery rate, and our state mandated goal is 35% for 2005. Third point, compaction of garbage could increase costs for all customers. WRS makes its money by reducing costs for apartment managers and owners, and then WRS takes a percentage of these savings. Human compaction of garbage in the apartment dumpsters increases the weight of the dumpsters. Haulers must pay for the disposal of the garbage according to the weight, so they experience an increase in costs, costs that would be recovered through customer rate increases down the road. And then finally, both in the Eugene Register Guard Report article yesterday and in statements this morning, it was stated that WRS is operating within sight of the city of Salem. I would like to know where they're operating inside of the city of Salem, because currently it's breaking the law. And is that the type of entity we want sorting through our personal information in our garbage? On behalf of the city of Salem, I request that you oppose Senate Bill 291, and am available for any questions.
I had a question. This business is totally new to me, so I don't really know how it operates. I assume that WRS doesn't go to facilities unless that facility owner has a contract with them and says, please come and help us with our garbage.
They're
just not going to be going through any miscellaneous garbage cans out on the street or someplace they don't have permission to be in.
Chair Ringel, members of the committee, no, they would typically negotiate with an apartment complex.
Are you concerned that people consider the garbage private information? I mean, one of the things you said is, you know, they can be going through anybody's garbage. I mean, is there a privacy issue for you?
Sure. For me personally, there is, and for the city of Salem, and I think that topic will be covered with one of the following speakers. But personally, yes. In the city of Salem, currently, identity theft is growing with the meth problem.
Right. Well, we all know that. Okay. Go ahead. Is it Ms. Duncan?
Ms. Vargas Duncan, Chair. I apologize for being late. We do have, we say in the city of Salem, our code enforcement's run like a machine, so frankly I was feeding the meter at 8 o'clock, but so pardon my lateness. But yes, I think it sounds like pretty much everything's already been covered. City of Salem did go through extensive work on this. The City Council had 16 questions for staff after the public hearing, and we submitted several pages, including a summary of all the other communities and how they operate. One thing that's unique here is that each city really is a little bit different in how we regulate our garbage and our haulers. And so to have a statewide solution to this, I don't think is appropriate in this case. I'd like to have the City of Salem at least be able to operate in the fashion in which we have, and we're meeting our recycling goals very, very well. Our haulers have been leaders in that area.
Thank you. Do you know of any other cities pass an ordinance such as this outlawing WRS?
I do know that a number of other cities had asked me for a copy of our ordinance after they learned of this.
Okay.
I'm not aware of any others that actually have made the change at this time. Perhaps another speaker after me will have more information about that.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any questions for the committee? All right. Now, Kristen, you want to go? And is it Robert Silo? Is that it?
Siglo.
Mm-hmm.
Close enough.
Okay. So,
good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Kristen Mitchell with Oregon Refuse and Recycling Association, and with me this morning is Bob Siglo, who manages the United Schools of Service operation in Woodburn and is also the president of the Mid-Valley Garbage and Recycling Association. Just as a quick response to your last question, yes, in fact, there are other communities that have enacted ordinances exactly like Salem's in order to maintain a better control over these types of businesses. McMinnville, Woodburn, Marion County are at least three that I can think of that have at least done so at this point. I agree with Senator Pozanski, who was here earlier, I think that it would be best to have a discussion really about recycling and the entire issue and keep it at that level, but this is unfortunately not a recycling bill. This is a bill which I don't believe you heard from the proponent. He talked about going around and removing recycled materials. What he didn't talk about is that in almost every case we've ever seen, his employees get in dumpsters, they jump up and down on the stuff to compact the load to cut the level of service. So that's the basic way that...
That is just to reduce the volume, like crush the boxes or crush containers.
Yes, in order to reduce the volume so that you don't have to have services frequently. That's correct.
Yeah. You know, just to push back a little bit, I have an office building with a dumpster and people throw boxes in and I have to jump in and crunch it down because otherwise it gets too full and people can't put their stuff in. It seems to me, I understand your issue about the weight. It doesn't solve weight, but it still seems like it's a valuable service because you get more stuff in there.
I understand that we're all about saving cost as well, Senator Ringo. We do it on behalf of our communities because when we save costs, you save costs. Councillor Haskell says he doesn't have any control over what happens in his community because he has a franchise hauler, and frankly, he has complete control. That's what that means. When you're a franchise hauler, that means you answer to your city, you answer to your county, you set the services that they demand you to do, you charge the prices they demand, you open your books, they know what your costs are. It's a completely regulated system, so I believe that he has not no control, but complete control. These containers are our containers. Our members own these containers. We have complete liability for what happens with them. There are national safety codes that say keep people out of these. Every container is posted with exactly that information. We don't allow our own employees to get into those containers. We certainly don't want to allow anyone else to. I can't imagine how we cannot be in the loop of liability if something does happen to one of these employees. You have pictures of Mr. Hoover's employees in these containers in all different locations. I've attached some to my testimony. I know that Mr. Siegel has attached some to his. There's the Salem videotape. And I don't want you to think that this just happens in Salem. I think that you might have gotten that impression from the proponent's testimony. The same thing has happened in other communities. The city of Tigard has told them no. There's a videotape that I've provided to the committee administrator that you can look at if you choose to that shows exactly what we talk about, different employees jumping up and down in these containers. These are garbage containers. They are not recycling containers. It's true that there may be recyclable materials in them, just as there may be recyclable materials in your own containers at your homes or other places of business. But that doesn't mean that the best way to deal with that is to go out and put somebody in there to drag stuff out of it. We've done waste sorts on all these different containers. You should consider an apartment complex just like a very large residence. And think about what you put in your container at your residence. That's exactly what goes in these containers on a bigger scale. In addition to other things, such as on one-way sort, we found a gallon container of needles, for example. That's just one thing that's in there. That's one of the many reasons that we don't let people get into our containers. Our employees are covered by every type of liability protection we can come up with. We follow all the rules from Oregon OSHA. We track them with bloodborne pathogens control plans. We have personal protective equipment, and we still don't let them in the container. So the next time you feel like you need to get in the container, please let us know, and maybe we can come by and help you out with a waste sort and do some educational work, which is what we really like to do.
Senator Shields.
Just a quick question or two. It seems to me that there's an old saying, you know, nature abhors a vacuum. When something's not being done, somebody comes along and does it. Given that we have a free market enterprise system going and apartment owners want to keep their costs down and so on and so forth, there's a vacuum here. And a service is being provided that kind of fills that vacuum. I realize it raises lots of liability questions and all that stuff, but have you, at the other end, tried to address the vacuum rather than, you know, talking about the dumpster diving and all that stuff?
Mr. Chair and Senator Shields, I think that we can say completely that we try and address the vacuum. We do a lot of educational work with these facilities. They're in Salem, they have a mixed recycling program similar to what the residents have, which makes it very simple. They throw all their recyclables in one container versus trying to sort them into the different types of materials. The garbage system is a little different than when you say just a free market system. It's regulated for reasons. There are health and safety concerns. It's really, truly a city or county service that they've moved to the private
side.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Am I not answering the question?
Yes. That's not the free market system I'm talking about. I'm talking about the apartment complex owner who's in business and meeting with others and trying to keep his costs down and so on. I understand your system's regulated, but those owners of those apartments, you know, they're the ones that are trying to compete, and this gentleman provides a service that in some senses you're not providing, you know.
You're true, that's correct.
I understand that you're trying to get the big boxes and so on and train the owners to sort and recycle and so on, but it doesn't happen. I've been in enough apartment complexes. Yeah, on my residence, fine, it works great, but I see what goes into these boxes, and I guess I'm with Senator Brzezinski at this point saying, look at the concept. I don't even think we should be bragging about meeting a 50% goal. That means we're not meeting the other 50%, you know. So I just guess I'm asking, have you given some serious consideration to trying to fill the vacuum?
Mr. Chair and Senator Shields, It's we do so much in recycling that it's hard for me to answer that question without just being kind of surprised. I mean, getting to 50% is a huge goal that's cost this state and its citizens a lot of money just to get there, and I think it is something to be really proud of. We can always do better. I think that anybody would say that that's true. I guess the question is whether we want to do better or even marginally change this or upset the system entirely on the backs of people that are getting in garbage containers. If you're asking if there are other ways, better ways to do apartment complex recycling, yes, I think we could do more. I think mixed recycling is a good start. It makes it easier for people. It's easier to train people as they come in and the tenants, and I understand that. But this is not truly about recycling. This is about getting into private property of others to make a buck. And I guess I would hate to see this legislature legitimize that kind of activity and encourage more people to do that. I don't see how you can answer the concerns about liability in this bill.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Okay.
I could go on. There's plenty more to
that's
say.
That's fine. I mean, the liability issue doesn't persuade me at all. I mean, I don't think you'd have liability on the folks who own the dumpster. I mean, the liability might go somewhere else, but I don't think there's any liability there because I don't think there's any actionable conduct. So let's hear from Mr. Siglo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Bob Siglo, and I'm president of Mid-Valley Garbage and Recycling Association, representing 7 garbage and recycling companies that serve Salem residents and businesses. I'm here this morning in opposition of Senate Bill 291, and I thank you for this opportunity to testify. The Mid-Valley Garbage and Recycling Association is very familiar with the proponent of this bill and his business activities because our experience with him in Salem in 2002. Our reasons for opposing his operations then are not different than our reasons for opposing this bill now. The proponent claims that his company pulls tons of recyclable materials from dumpsters at apartment complexes. Our experiences with him in 2002 proved that, in reality, his employees remove very little recycling from the dumpsters. Instead, what they do is act as human compactors, getting into garbage dumpsters and jumping up and down on the contents until the garbage is packed down enough that the dumpster does not have to be serviced as often. I have attached pictures to my testimony so that you can see for yourself. This is common practice. Of all these pictures are the proponents, employees, and actions and were taken at different locations in the Salem area in 2002. In some cases, if the employees still could not get the lids closed on the dumpsters after their human compaction efforts, they would pull garbage out of the dumpster and haul it to another account that they had that had more room in its dumpster. The City of Salem's Community Enforcement Office also captured these activities on videotape, and I understand this is available for the committee to review. After the City of Salem investigated the proponent's activities, the City Council unanimously denied his request to operate this way in Salem. This bill would overrule that decision.
According to this bill, anyone claiming to pull recycling from garbage containers can enter those containers without the permission of the owner or of the container. This raises serious unanswered concerns for us regarding our liability for potential personal injuries to the people who enter these containers. We do not and would not allow our own employees to get into dumpsters in this manner. And they are covered by workers' compensation insurance, and they have appropriate protective gear, and they follow bloodborne pathogen exposure control plans. Shouldn't we have the right to keep others out of our private property as well? I heard in recent news report that Marion County has the highest incidence in identity theft in Oregon, and that the county is second in methamphetamine cases. Why would the legislature want to encourage more people to have access to garbage that might contain sensitive information? When people throw stuff in the garbage, that is where they expect it to stay. How would any of us feel if someone was going through our personal garbage for any reason? This bill is not about recycling. In fact, it would undermine the recycling programs that currently exist. The City of Salem and garbage and recycling collectors it regulates offer outstanding recycling options to its residents and businesses, and we collect the information to prove it. Every year, we track and report all of our recycling statistics, as we are required to do by state law. In fact, in the DEQ's most recent report about statewide recycling effort, Marion County's recovery rate is 53%, second only to Metro Region. Senate Bill 291 is a step back for recycling. Please do not pass this bill. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I have a question.
Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. Help me understand this. I'm reading from their. I'm actually trying to understand what the problem is. I'm reading from their waste recovery systems presentation. And there's a paragraph here that says, how do we make our money? This company contracts with owners of apartments. They become responsible for the garbage bills. Therefore, the better we manage the garbage, the more money we can make. By removing recyclables from the container, we are able to lower the amount of pickups or reduce the size of garbage in the can. Help me understand the problem here. I apologize. I know you've all come to see me, but I got to tell you, after hearing the testimony, I'm a little attracted to the entrepreneurialism of all this. I mean, if they're going to stomp on trash and figure out how to make money off of stomping on trash, there's a little attraction.
In Salem, in some of the recycling services that. Or some of the businesses he had under contract, we had gone in and proposed the commingled recycling service, where people, we have the containers out there, people can throw their recycling material in there and know what they're throwing in there. So if they have confidential information, that goes in the garbage that they want to get rid of, but their recycling material can go in this other container. And it's completely up to them which way they go. And we have actually saved that apartment complex more money than Waste Recovery Systems was under their program without doing anything illegal or unsafe.
Okay, so there's competition. That's fine. What's wrong with the business model?
Well, I think it's just the practice, the way that Waste Recovery Systems does it.
Mr. Chair and Senator Atkinson, if you're okay with somebody getting in the private property of someone else, which is our containers, and jumping up and down on garbage, which is garbage, not recyclables, regardless of the fact that there's recyclables in there, and you think that that's an okay way to run a business, and you can tell us that we have absolutely no liability when we're the owner of those boxes and we're liable for everything else that attaches to them, we're all for saving money too. But if the proponent would like to take those contracts and spend the time to educate tenants about how to do things correctly and do it in a safe way, he could probably do that, and then maybe he could save the money as well. But the red herring of increased recycling here is not what's happening. And if you want to talk about stomping on the containers and saving some money, then I guess that's a completely different issue.
Wait, hang on a second. Tiffany Harris is going to want this room in 5 minutes. Rules committee starts. Am I right?
Correct.
You want us to leave?
Last question.
Would this all be solved if they own their own cans?
Mr. Chair and Senator Atkinson, I know of one community where that's what they've done. The city council made the choice to say, we're not going to let you make the garbage hauler in this community liable, but if you want to go do that yourself, you can. I believe that's in Corvallis. But on the other hand, sir, then at what point do you need this legislation? I think the point of this is to allow a local community to decide how they want to run their programs.
All right. Well, hang on a minute. Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Siegel, appreciate your coming today.
Thank you.
This is an interesting bill. Art Schlock, Willie, were you going to testify? Are you on the list here? Bob Danko?
Willie doesn't work.
Oh, Willie, you're not on the list. Bob, could you come up, please? And I'm sorry for giving me such little time. Do you both have written material?
I do not, Mr.
Okay,
Chair.
Well, why don't you give us your 30-second art and...
60 seconds.
60 seconds is fine.
Let me be Art Schlock with the Association of Oregon Counties. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we are pleased to be here today. We are in opposition to Senate Bill 291. I think the issue here is not the individual company, but the issue here is the question of local control and responsibility. Counties maintain a franchise authority and responsibility as it relates to waste management. As part of that responsibility, we deal with the question of recycling, which you've heard a lot about today. Through that, we establish recycling programs in conjunction with those individuals that have a franchise within our communities at this point. That is very important to us, and I would say that recycling is a number one priority in terms of waste management in all counties. Counties in Eastern Oregon have established recycling programs. If the question is recycling and the amount of recycling that is being done, then we should look at the statutes as it relates to what is required in terms of recycling. And if necessary, then if we want to increase those, that certainly would be appropriate. Then it would be up to the local communities as how to achieve that at this point. This bill, at least as I read it, goes beyond a commercial waste disposal bin.
We talked about that. This bill says that somebody could come through my garbage to do recycling without my permission. I agree. We got to fix that. Okay.
So we're concerned about not only that, but the curbside. And I would just, Mr. Chair, in concluding at this point, identity theft is a major, major issue at this point that local government has to deal with. And the only way that we can deal with it is through franchising. If an individual wants to come forward and ask as part of the franchise to be part of a system, then the local government should have the ability to make that decision and to establish whatever conditions or requirements are appropriate.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry, Mr. Danko. Why don't you
Mr. Chair?
Yes, 30 seconds.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bob Danko with the Department of Environmental Quality. We do not have a position on this bill. It's not really a statewide issue.
Okay.
However, on page 3, line 40 and 41, we have issue with those words there. They're not critical to the bill, but right now, the way it's written, it would remove the requirement for education promotion of recycling with multifamily dwelling units itself, and we have a problem with that. We also have a technical problem with the word source on line 41.
Okay.
It's not necessarily source separation.
Well, work with us on that. I really appreciate it. Thanks, all of you, for coming to testify. And so let's go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 291. You know, just a comment on Senate Bill 291. I think there's interest in the committee on doing something on this bill, and so I would just encourage the proponents and opponents to get together and see what we can do. And with that, this committee is adjourned.